All right, so we're in the middle of a proof, and the proof is, we've already shown that in, there's a reduction step. We're trying to prove that when we take the Fourier transform of a regular semi-simple over literal, that it's a nice function, and the reduction step said, okay, it's enough to do that in the elliptic case because we can reduce to that case. That means at this point, we have the following situation. T is elliptic, and we've got some element X that's an elliptic element in that, that happens to be in that Cartan subalgebra. And we're trying to show let me take the Fourier transform of its orbital integral to a nice function. Now, as I was saying at the end of last time, let's choose a little compact neighborhood, a little compact open neighborhood of X inside of here. All right, so I'll put X inside of omega sub T, contained in the regular set of T, and I want it to be compact open. The purpose of this is what we already know is that there are certain smeared out combinations of orbital integrals, elliptic orbital integrals, that we know give nice functions when we take the Fourier transform. And now we're going to be taking such functions, I called them phi before, and they will be supported on the conjugates of omega t. That's the role that omega t is going to play. And now let me formulate again the statement that we have at the end, and we'll discuss how to prove it. This is the next step in the proof. The orbital integral that we care about, this particular one here for this elliptic X that we've got, it's in the closure of the kinds of things we had last time, the I sub phi's, that were these smeared out versions, where phi ranges through the functions, and it's just what I was saying. Take the compact set omega t and take all the conjugates of it. Just apply the adjoint action to omega t. And that gives us a subspace of the distributions on the Lie algebra G. Okay, so it's a linear subspace, and then we have this kind of notion of closure that involved a very weak kind of topology where you use the discrete topology on C and its pointwise convergence of linear functionals. Oh, well, why is this true? So let me call it claim, and this is just the proof of the claim, and then we'll have to continue with the proof of the theorem. All right, the proof of the claim goes like this. Well, one thing, if we have to during the course of the proof, we can shrink. It's okay to shrink this neighborhood, and I will in a minute, because of course that just makes the space smaller, and if we can prove it's in the closure of a smaller space, we're fine. So it's okay to shrink omega t to make it more convenient later. And now I want to reformulate what it means to be in this closure. You can say it in another way. I'll just leave this as an exercise. So it's just unwinding this kind of topology that we have on the linear functionals. All right, so what we really need to prove is, must show, this is the reformulated version, we have to show that when all of these linear functionals that we're considering in the subspace vanish on a given test function, then this one vanishes. That's what it really, that's what this topology does for you, sort of makes this be true. For all the functions in here, this implies that the linear functional we're interested in is zero. I mean, certainly if this guy is actually in here, then that's certainly true, but the ones that are in the closure, it's also true for. If we were working on a finite dimensional vector space and using this kind of topology, then this closure wouldn't do anything. if you use this kind of very weak topology on a finite dimensional vector space and the dual of it, then the closure of the subspace would just be the subspace. But here we pick up a little more stuff. As usual, we need to use the Weyl integration formula to see the relationship between these OXs and the I phis. All right, we need some way to compare the two things. And the formula, the Weyl integration formula, when you use it to understand I sub phi, we don't have a sum anymore because all the terms are zero unless we're working with the sum and for this particular torus. That's just because of the nature of this function I phi. It's only supported on conjugates of things in T, so everything else just vanishes. As usual, a discriminant factor. The orbital integrals of F, the orbital integrals of phi. All right, it's very easy to see that if you go back to what the definition of the I sub phi was. And in a sense, that means I don't have to really recall what the I sub phi is because this serves, this says what it is. That's another way of saying what I sub phi is. And then you have to think about the nature of what's coming out here. When we think of this guy as a function of x, this is locally constant function of x. And you can say the same of this one, but you can say more because of the support property that phi has. So this thing is a function of x, is locally constant and compactly supported function on omega t. You see, it's different with this f, which is an arbitrary test function. The orbital integrals are not, they're compactly supported on t, but not on the regular set, say. But here things, it's very good because the phi has such small support that in fact it's actually compactly supported on omega t. That's an important thing. But now, to get the conclusion we want, this is the function of x in, well, I'm thinking of it as a function of x in t, so I don't need to. The Weyl group here is going to tell me the Weyl group conjugate. Okay, so there's a small glitch here, but it's going to go away in a minute because we're going to shrink this thing. I didn't say it quite right. All right. So we'll fix this in a minute. Thanks. All right, because in order to analyze this, in fact, I do want to shrink the omega t, so I sort of said that too soon. Let's go back to our picture that we, or not some picture, I don't know what it is, something. These orbital integrals? Yes, that's right. Right, so the Schleicher germs tell you in what way they fail to be locally constant as you approach a singular point. But we're going to end up only caring what's happening on this compact subset of the regular semi-simple of the regular elements in there. So it's all going to be fine. On the actual part that we're looking at, everything's locally constant, and there won't be any trouble. Okay, I want to go back to the same thing that we had before. We used this when proving the Weyl integration formula, and it comes up again now. The way I want to shrink, remember this thing, we calculated the Jacobian, and it was always non-zero. So this thing is the differential is an isomorphism at all points. It's a map
with a...
It's a sort of an immersion, but it's not injective, because there's some vial group action, which is just what was, which is what make that tiny bit wrong, to really get rid of that finite to one nature, you need to mod out by the action of the vial group. But there's another way to handle that, because the Jacobian is non-zero, it is an isomorphism locally, and that means by taking a small enough omega t and a small neighborhood here, I can just make this thing be an isomorphism. Okay, so let me do that, and I'm going to write omega for every case. Omega will be a compact open subset, and here I want a compact open subset in there, and here I want a compact open subset in there, of course, again, containing x, and this is supposed to be a compact open neighborhood of the base point, and I want a compact open set here, omega g. And by making these guys small, I can make this thing actually be not just an immersion, but also make it injective. Rather than finite to one, it'll be just injective. So I forget what that's called. Inverse function theorem or something. All right, and now the deal is, when we do our orbital integral, we're in a product situation. The orbital integrals, we have a function here, okay? And if we take one that is supported on there, so we take a function that's actually supported on here, that neighborhood is so small that it looks like this. We're taking orbital integrals, and that just means we're doing this integral over g mod t. In other words, we're integrating over this part of the product. And when you have this smooth function of compact support on this little guy here, which is a product, and you integrate it, you will get a smooth function of compact support on here, which is what I was saying, so now it's been fixed. But moreover, you can get anything on here. Any smooth compactly supported function can be obtained in this way. Because among the smooth compactly supported functions on this product, you have the ones that are just pulled back from this factor and are constant on here. And when you integrate those over this thing, you'll just get that function back again. All right, so this has been fixed. But actually the main thing is, we see now that actually we can produce, if we just specify some function we want to come out here for a suitable choice of phi, we can do it. Moreover. How has that been fixed? Because I made this thing be bijective. No. You know what? I see what you're saying. Yeah, very good. No, it's fixed by this, I haven't gotten the logic of it straightened out right. You're absolutely right. Thank you. I mean, it's fixed by this anyway. So the point is, I can delete that and then just take the part of it that's, we get, by the time I've made it this small, then I'll have the small thing I want, and then some vial group translates of it. And the fact that we're doing it too many times is just accounted for by the fact we divide out by there. But I can just delete that and then just take the part of omega t. All right, so anyway, it's getting sort of I give up. I'm going to just say it as if it's correct, even though it's slightly wrong. It's not important. Moreover, we can get any function in C infinity C of omega t from a suitable phi. And now we're done because how does the thing work? We want to take a function f for which all of these things are zero. All right, so we take a specific function f. We assume that this quantity is zero all the time for all these phi's. But here we can put essentially anything because of this remark down here. And the only way you can have a function such as this integral against anything is zero means that this thing is zero. All right. And so now let me call that thing right there star vanishing. Therefore, vanishing of star for all phi implies vanishing of this thing. Well, that takes care of the, in a slightly rough-hewn fashion, it takes care of the claim, and now we have to use the claim to finish the proof of the theorem. Let me kind of summarize. I've already sort of done it, but so the first point is that when we take these I phi's and take the Fourier transform, the thing we proved last time was that is a nice function. That's okay. And well, the only ones we got to use were ones supported in the elliptic set. And of course, that includes the ones we were just using. These guys that we're using are supported on the elliptic set. And second point is this is the thing we just did, the claim. The orbital integral that we're interested in is, in some sense, a limit of I phi's for this Punnett quality is a limit of I phi's. Okay, so now I think with those two things on the board, it's clear what the strategy is going to be. However, there's something important that's still missing, and that's what's called Howe's finiteness theorem. All right, so now we need Howe's finiteness theorem. It's actually the analog of something we've already seen. In the case of PGL2, when we were working with a group rather than the Lie algebra, we had that surprising finiteness result. We looked at spherical functions, the ones that were k bi-invariant, and we took orbital integrals for all possible elements coming from k. And we found out that even though we had infinitely many, that they gave us a finite dimensional space of linear functionals on that Hecke algebra H. Well, that's an instance of what used to be called, or maybe still is, Howe's conjecture on the group, although it's actually a theorem due to Clausel on the group now. All right, so there's Howe's result, conjecture, or theorem, or whatever, on the group, proved by Clausel, and had been conjectured by Howe. But there's also the corresponding thing on the Lie algebra, and that's what we need right now. All right, so how does it go? To state it, I need a compact open subgroup of this additive group. I mean, the Lie algebra is a group under addition, and take a compact open subgroup. It plays the same role as the compact open subgroup K did when we took the spherical Hecke algebra. And just to stress that, I'm going to do something slightly strange. I mean, this is not very customary notation. I'm just doing it to emphasize the analogy. Let's look at the functions which are compactly supported, as usual, but actually translation invariant, under the compact open subgroup.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
G is the algebra?
What's that?
G is the algebra.
G is the algebra.
And L is the...
Compact open subgroup of the additive group of that Lie algebra. Okay, so we can, if we have a function like this that's invariant under translations by the compact open subgroup, it's certainly locally constant. And any one of the, so as you let L get smaller and smaller, you'll pick up all locally constant compact and supported functions. For every compact and supported locally constant function, there exists a small enough compact open subgroup so that the guy sits in there. But I want to fix one particular level and only look at the one sitting there. Okay, I'm not, it, anyway, it's just something. It's just a function space that we're calling H. But again, given the distribution, we can just restrict it to there. So given D, a distribution on the Lie algebra, can consider its restriction. Just look at it on test functions coming from that smaller space, but still infinite dimensional. And of course, this will live just in the dual vector space. That's a, H is a vector space, and we can take that algebraic dual vector space, palm to C. And then Howe's finiteness theorem says that I need one more thing to formulate it. Suppose we take a compact set. Take a compact set of the Lie algebra, and now we need some analog of what we did before for PGL2. We only looked at orbital integrals coming from K. Now this is going to play the role of K. We want to limit which orbital integrals we take, but actually the theorem works just with invariant distributions. They don't have to be orbital integrals. More generally then, we can consider the following thing. I'm going to look at restrictions to H of what? Well, D will be an invariant distribution on G. Supported on the closure of, and now we use our compact set for an invariant distribution. Of course, you need to smear it out by conjugation before considering what it, before using it to control the support. So we apply add G to this thing and then take the closure. So support on the closure of, just take add G and you conjugate things in this compact set in all possible ways. All right, so that's some space of distributions. And of course, H is infinite dimensional as before. D is, there's certainly infinitely many there's an infinite dimensional space of distributions D like this. If you take an orbital integral for an element in this compact set, that'll be in there, for example. But once again, the statement is that this is a finite dimensional space nevertheless. So this is, that's the theorem. This is finite dimensional. And I'm not going to discuss the proof. I'm just going to say that, well, it's similar. I mean, we saw this phenomenon concretely in that PGL2 case, and I'll leave it at that. The comment I do want to make, instead of, I won't say anything about the proof, but rather I will say that part of what you'll hear in DeBacher's talks is that nowadays this has been, it's been superseded. This is obviously a very qualitative kind of result. It just applies to any compact set whatsoever, any compact open subgroup L whatsoever. But the point is, for certain choices of L, when this thing comes from a Moy-Prasad filtration lattice, you can say, let me say it in a qualitative kind of way, you can say how big you can make this and have the theorem still work. So you'll see things like that when DeBacher speaks. But now, how do we use this kind of thing here? Let's apply the... for all. No, if you fix... No, I see. I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't... Actually, I didn't say the right thing exactly. But it's going to be too complicated if I try to... it was just confused by my... Let me not try to say it. DeBacher will have to explain it. I mean, the thing you want is somehow to have... You want the nilpotent orbital integrals to form a basis. You want something stronger. So not only does it end up being finite dimensional, but it's actually... it ends up being... having as a basis the nilpotent orbital integrals. So you know precisely what it is in those cases. Yeah, I'm sorry. I explained it very poorly. But we were seeing that in PGL2, where we got a two-dimensional space corresponding to the fact that there were two unipotent elements. So that's the part that you... That's the other thing you need before what I said makes sense. Thanks for fixing that. That actually was a strange statement to have made. All right. Now, we're going to apply it here. As we were just discussing, we can do this for any compact, and which one should we use? Let's use our compact omega sub t that we had from before. I want to return to our discussion here, and we'll use this omega t here. Apply Howe's theorem to omega t from before. To see that. Well, now, as long as I take guys whose support gives me stuff in, now we'll be considering in Howe's theorem just the thing we were considering before, namely apply add G to omega T. As long as I have things that are supported in there and I restrict them to this space H, okay, so L is, and L is just arbitrary. I don't want to fix L yet. We should do it for any L, but for the omega T we had from before. What we see is that all the guys that we've been considering, these orbital integrals OX and the I sub phis, they're all of the type that's being considered here. And that means that all of them together, the OX, the I phis, all those things, they all give you a finite dimensional space of linear functionals on H. You see that OX restricted to H, say for X and omega T, I phi restricted to H, phi as above. All these things that we've been considering lie in some finite dimensional subspace of the dual of H. So why does that matter? It's because of that thing I said earlier, that this condition of coming back to this kind of thing, if you've got a bunch of linear functionals that vanish on something, let's see what I want to say. I mean, if you know, right, if you have a collection of linear functionals such that the vanishing of those linear functionals on some vector implies the vanishing of some other linear functional on that vector, and if you're in a finite dimensional situation, it means that remaining linear functional was just a linear combination of the other ones. That's just the way linear algebra works in finite dimensional vector spaces. Now, we wouldn't have been able to get the desired conclusion before because we were working in an infinite dimensional space where all we would have is the thing would be some limit. But now when you do this restriction, instead of saying that OX is a limit of the I phis, we actually have that O sub X must be equal to some I phi after restricting to H. So conclusion, now we use two in the summary. Using two in summary, get that the thing is not just a limit, but it's actually equal to I phi, well, but not really, it's just a restriction. Now we have to take the Fourier transform of this statement. All right, so I have the Fourier transform and the Fourier transform. But after all, we can't say that those two things are equal because all we know is that the restrictions of the original things are equal when restricted to functions that are translation invariant under L up here. So you have to think what that means in the Fourier transformed picture. But it's very easy. It means that these things are actually equal when they're restricted to, it actually becomes easier to think about, inside of the Lie algebra, we have the perpendicular space. What's that? No, but these are a linear subspace. Because it's I of the sum is the sum of the I's. It's additive in the phi variable, yeah. So I don't need to take a linear combination. I just say there is an I phi for a particular. It doesn't matter. I mean, a linear combination would have been just as good, but we don't need to do it. Where L perp is just equal to, it's somehow the Pontryagin perpendicular lattice, or subgroup, Pontryagin perpendicular. When you have the duality, you have a locally compact abelian group and the dual locally compact abelian group, you can look inside your group at some subgroup, closed subgroup, and then you can look at all the characters in a dual that annihilate that subgroup. All right, so whenever you have an abelian group and its dual, a dual, and you have a subgroup B, you have B perpendicular, those are the characters of A that are the trivial character on B. Now, in our situation where we've kind of identified the Lie algebra with the Pontryagin dual of the Lie, of itself. But anyway, as L gets smaller and smaller, the perpendicular things get bigger and bigger. Because they're the things that are trivial on that smaller and smaller thing, that's less and less of a condition. That means that the L perpendiculars fill out the entire Lie algebra. So that's why we wanted to make L arbitrary and then let it vary. Now we let it get smaller and smaller. What we know is, from before, this is point number one, this thing is nice. This is a nice function. We know that this thing's a locally L1 function, therefore its restriction to this compact is actually an L1 function on L perpendicular. And therefore this is an L1 function. But that's true for all L perps, and that means that this thing is a locally L1 function. True for all L, union of L perp equals everything, therefore this guy is locally L1 function.
All right, so that's how that proof goes. You reduce to the smeared-out version by using Howe's finiteness theorem. And you see then why that's an important thing. Now I want to also, I want to tie things together a little bit by going back to Schleicher germs. Where Howe's finiteness theorem also lets you say something better. And then we'll also take the Fourier transform as we've been doing, But anyway, let me just start. I think I just have to start writing.
So this maybe should be called the Lie algebra analog of Harishchandra's local character expansion,
which I'll get to shortly, I hope.
All right. Now I want to use notation
similar to the group case, but we're in the Lie algebra, so
these would be nilpotent. These would be the nilpotent orbits rather than the unipotent orbits. And then we'll have the nilpotent orbital integrals corresponding to those nilpotent orbits. And again, there's a theory of Schleicher germs. These are now Schleicher germs on the Lie algebra. Actually, I should say, though, they're better in a sense because there's a way to make them canonical so that they actually are not germs anymore. They're actually well-defined functions. But I'm not going to stress that because I'm running short on time, but somehow the situation is a little better. So these are better, can be made into actual, you know, functions, not just germs of functions. And you do, and the way you do that is because the germs of them, which you do get, as in the group case, the germs have a certain kind of homogeneity property. And that homogeneity property allows you to scale back and define them, just sort of analytically continue that scaling property that they have. So there's a way to do it to get the, and they become nicer because you actually have well-defined functions, not just germs. Okay, now let's, as before, consider a compact open subgroup.
Use similar notation.
And here's some facts. And let me use H as before, okay? As before. One thing that's useful to know is that these nilpotent orbital integrals remain linearly independent. But that's sort of a technical thing. I just wanted to mention it. Don't worry about it too much. Sorry? Yeah, H is exactly the same. Like right there. I'm just keeping the same notation. So that fact I just mentioned is kind of implicit in what I was saying before, that I was saying that in these favorable cases, when this very precise version of Hall's theorem that DeBacher will discuss, you actually get the nilpotent orbital integrals forming a basis of something. Well, if they hadn't been linearly independent, that wouldn't have been reasonable. But the fact that they actually remain linearly independent. Here's another thing. So this is uniformity of Schleicher-Germ expansions. And again, when you prove this, you're going to need Howe's finiteness theorem, and that's why I'm discussing at this point. We're not going to get into the details of it, but use Howe's finiteness theorem. But the outcome of it is, this is part of why I'm saying it, this result is analogous to what we saw, again, for PGL2 when we did the group case, PGL2, and script H was that spherical Heck algebra. All right, so this is a Lie algebra analog of that statement. Here's the statement. So there exists a neighborhood U of 0 in the Lie algebra, depends on L, such that when we look at regular semi-simple guys that are in that small neighborhood of the origin, we take the orbital integral of x, we're restricted to h, and then we have our Schleicher germs occurring, and the nilpotent orbitals restricted to H. If you think back to what we did before, it's just exactly like it.
Before we were taking orbitals O gamma on the spherical guys, and we saw we could write them as linear combinations of Schleicher germs times restrictions of unipotent orbitals.
It's really the same thing.
But here is a general statement of that kind. But again, it's a qualitative statement. That's all you can get out of something like Hollis finiteness theorem. To get a better version, you need one of these refinements that I was alluding to. But this is the qualitative version you get from Hollis theorem, where you don't know how big U is.
Okay.
And then,
three.
That's right. The uniformity is in H. Just as before, it's infinite dimensional, and if we only had finitely many functions out of it, then for sure we could, we could take the intersection of the neighborhoods that work for each individual function. But for it to work at all of them at the same time, that's not obvious.
But Hollis finiteness theorem lets you boil it down to a finite number. That's the deal. Okay, so now let's consider the following thing. We look at a regular semi-simple guy, X,
and we're going to look at the Fourier transform of its orbital integral, which is the thing we've been looking at recently.
But so we know it's a function now. But for any X, regular semi-simple, there exists a neighborhood V of 0 in G such that. This last point is what I referred to in the heading for this section, the algebra analog of Harshchandra's local character expansion. So the point is, as I tried to indicate last time, when you take the Fourier transform of that orbital integral, it behaves like a character.
So this thing should be thought of as the Lie algebra analog of an irreducible
character on the group.
Harshchandra's local character expansion on the group says that when you take this character,
viewed as a function,
and look at it near the origin, it has an expansion in terms of unipotent orbital integrals.
Well, or nilpotent orbital integrals on the Lie algebra. And again, it's the same deal in this case, only in a sense it's better because we actually find out what the coefficients are. So the Lie algebra case is
finish writing.
Yeah, so this is, I didn't use my V yet.
This is sort of on.
On the regular elements in V.
In other words, I'm now thinking of all these things as functions. This Fourier transform here is a function. Just like a germs are functions. This, all right, we didn't prove it, but I told you that actually it was true that the Fourier transforms of any orbital integrals, they actually are all functions. We did the regular semi-simple case, and to argue that all orbital integrals or Fourier transforms are functions, you have to use Hollis finiteness theorem, but you have to unfortunately use other things that we didn't have time for, like the linear independence of Schleicher germs, which is a non-trivial thing. But anyway, so we have. We have everything here as a function, and then the statement is that the equality is not valid everywhere, but just on a small neighborhood of zero. So it's a local statement around the origin. But it's completely analogous to what happens on the group, where you have an irreducible character being expressed. Well, then you don't know. You just have some linear combinations. So these are some things called C sub O, some constants. But again, Fourier transforms of nilpotent orbital integrals that lift it up to the group by the exponential map, where they become unipotent orbital integrals essentially.
Do you need to know the
H-spec
time function?
What's that?
Do you need to know the H-spec time function?
Do I need to know that the nilpotent ones?
No, for the regular ones, you need to already know that you spent the
I forget whether, I mean, somehow, the way you would develop the theory, you would know it at this point. But, I mean, I'd sort of have to go back step by step to think whether you didn't need, if there's a way to do without it. I would guess that you do need to know it, but still, I'd have to actually go back and check. So I can't answer for sure. Now, three actually follows from two partially, not totally, but... I'll just make as a remark. When, remember we had an open set U, yeah, here. So for all X in U, as in 2, intersected G regular semi-simple, this follows from 2, just by applying the Fourier transform. Right, so that's not a complete proof that you get 3 from 2, but it's a start on it anyway. All right, and then when Harshchandra proves the local character expansion on the group, he actually uses the Lie algebra version again. No, but it goes the same. The argument goes the same way. It goes just the same way because again, we're going to have. We'll get an L perp coming in just for the same reason. It's quite parallel to what we did over here, so I won't repeat it. But use the same. No, there's two open sets. I mean, one's coming from the L and the L perp. I mean. Anyway, I think it's okay and it makes sense when you think it through using the same procedure as before. Now I want to discuss two things on the group. One is I already said in words what the local character expansion is. Now I want to write it up there. So let's talk about the local. I'll just formulate it. I mean, as I just said, one of the things that Harshchandra uses in his proof on the group is this Lie algebra version. Actually, in a more general form. I mean, there's a version of this in which you will just get a linear combination of nilpotent Fourier transforms and nilpotent orbit integrals, where you just when you have a more general thing on the left side. So in reality, you have to use an even more general version of this that I won't formulate. This one has the virtue of being a case where you can see what the coefficients are. But anyway, what is the group situation? I more or less said it, but let me write it. So it's a p-adic group, connected reductive as usual, and pi an irreducible representation. And theta pi, well, okay, so part of this whole story in this development of Harshchandra is he proves that character is a locally L1 function, locally constant of the regular set. So this is the character of pi. Obviously, this is a distribution, and it's hard to prove it's a locally L1 function, but using the same kinds of things we've been talking about, plus additional stuff. It does turn out to be a function of the same general nature as we've been seeing. And now I use the exponential function to identify a neighborhood of 0 in the Lie algebra with a neighborhood of 1 in the group. All right, so I use x to identify neighborhood of 0 in G with neighborhood of 1 in the group G. And then this neighborhood may be too big because, of course, in these expansions, you just have some unknown neighborhood. We may have to shrink it. So after shrinking the neighborhoods, this depends on pi. Okay. Okay, so for some pies, you have to shrink it a lot. After shrinking the neighborhood, this depends on pi, then we think of this character as a function on a neighborhood of zero in the Lie algebra, and then you have a similar thing. It's a linear combination of these guys.
Restriction of the character to the neighborhood, which we can think about in the group or Lie algebra at will, and I want to think about it in the Lie algebra. Thinking of it in the Lie algebra is a linear combo of mu 1 hat, mu r hat.
All right, so this is yet another one of these parts of the analogy that goes through. The group character really does behave like the Fourier transform of an orbital integral. They have the same qualitative nature in many, many respects. This is one of them. This is not at all obvious, so there's a lot more stuff at the end of the Queen's paper, admissible invariant distributions on whatever. So Farrar-Schwender has to use a lot more to go from the Lie algebra case to the group case. And I don't know how much Stephen will talk about that. I'm not sure. Now another thing that I want to talk about to tie things together, this is a new heading,
but I'm putting it is I want to again, first of all, make a tie-in with things we've done. Matrix coefficients of supercusmal representations have the property that when you take their orbital integrals for elliptic elements, you get the character, essentially, for that representation. But then the beautiful thing is, if you are on a non-elliptic element, you have to take the weighted orbital integral. So these things behave in a way that's completely parallel, and again, analogous to things we were seeing in the Lie algebra. And I want to make this point. Since we only discussed the weighting factors for PGL2, I mean, that's the only reason I'm going back to PGL2. Of course, these are general things, but we're limited because I only did the weighting factor in that case. So we're back to G equals PGL2. We had orbital integrals. We had the weighted orbital integral that came up last time. But now the thing is, we can do the analogous thing on the group. All right, we have also, this is on G, Lie algebra. And now on the group, we can form just gamma being regular semisimple. We can form the orbital integral. And if, suppose that gamma is a regular element in the split torus A, the usual diagonal split torus A, take a regular element gamma in there, then we will have a weighted orbital integral for gamma. So just to make sure it's clear what I mean, the weighted orbital integral for gamma of a function f on the group will be equal to the integral, so f is smooth convex support on the group, will be the integral over A divided into G, f, G inverse gamma G, times d of x, dg dot, where x is, as usual, the thing obtained by applying the vertex you get by applying g to the base vertex, and d of x is the distance to the apartment. Sorry, the weighting factor had a 2 in it. I almost forgot. So it was twice the distance to the apartment. Same weighting factor as before. Okay, so weighted orbit integral has the same structure. You're just doing the orbit in the group instead of the Lie algebra, but the weight factor is the same. Anyway, we have these group analogs, and now here's the beautiful thing. Suppose we take a supercuspidal representation of PGL2. I'll explain what this means in a second. Let me first introduce the contragradient.
That's just the dual representation where you make sure to make the vectors smooth vectors. So you take a subspace of the algebraic dual in the usual way, and then take a vector. No, take a vector in the representation, take a vector in the contour gradient, and like we did when we were talking about the compact case, let's normalize things so that the value of the linear functional on the vector is 1, and then form a matrix coefficient. But I'm going to build in the formal degree, so I'm going to make it like this. Let's actually define a function f sub pi, which is basically a matrix coefficient, but we put in the formal degree. Okay, it's infinite dimensional, so it's not the degree like it was before, but there's something called the formal degree, which I won't discuss. It depends on a choice of Haar measure. Or in other words, the formal degree isn't really a number anymore. It's actually, if you think canonically, it's a Haar measure, but if you have another Haar measure, you can take the ratio and get a number. So here's the beautiful statement. So then, all right, we can look at the character of this supercuspidal guy. By Harris-Chandra's theory, it's a function. And now let's look at the value on some regular element in some maximal torus T. And this will now look exactly like what we had before when we were discussing Fourier transforms of elliptic orbital integrals. Namely, we get the orbital integral of our matrix coefficient if T is elliptic. Then we get the negative, just like before, of the weighted orbital integral if T is A. I mean, up to conjugation, I might as well assume T is A if T is split. All right, so the formal structure of the way these things work is just the same. And this is something that can be proved using the local trace formula on the group, of course, rather than on the Lie algebra. But actually, the way it went historically, if you look back at the list of references I gave to Arthur's papers on the local trace formula, you'll find that the first ones I gave, maybe it was the second one in the list, but there was one that where the supercuspidal characters or something is in the title, and he proved that actually before developing the general local trace formula. It's easier to prove this special case than the general case. So you can do it either way. You can use things like the local trace formula as you did at first, or you can actually use the local trace formula. And however, no matter how you do it, the key thing is still the same, namely that computation we did in the tree is what leads to this factor here. And you can do that, you could look at his early paper on the supercuspidal case and use that calculation in the tree to sort of see what's going on in the case of PGL2. That makes that paper easy to understand. Sorry? So when we had those fees, so remember we were considering for a while, I guess it was last time, very special tests. This is no longer a test function, it's just a function, but a very special one that's actually supported on the elliptic set. And then what I mentioned last time was, in some sense, the Fourier transform of this thing it's a Lie algebra analog of a matrix of F pi. It behaves the same way. And so if you look back, that kind of backs up that statement I made last time. You see that that's correct. All right. Now, I was able to finish most of what I wanted to do in this course. There was one thing which I had originally thought I would do, and it became clear right away that there wouldn't be time to do it. I wanted to actually explain the weighting factor and just in, at least in rough terms, how it comes about in higher rank, in the higher rank case. And I didn't have time to do that. But what I'm thinking is, actually, I would like to give one additional talk next week on that on an informal basis. There's no pressure to come. I mean, simply for those, if you feel like you already know as much as you want to know about harmonic analysis, that's fine. But for those who are curious about how this, the function that we calculated, this U sub whatever M, this U sub N thing that involved the integral of the characteristic function, H inverse AG. We did that using the tree for PGL2, but I'd like to discuss how that part of the thing goes, because it's a very important part, at least heuristically in the higher rank cases, but still maybe a split group. So I was thinking maybe something like 4 o'clock on Monday, if one of the rooms is available. And, you know, if you're interested, come. Otherwise, it's the course really is done, and I think it sort of makes sense as a unit as it is. But if you're curious, then you're welcome to come.